Well, the chapter that we're going to talk about today is called The Banquet Hall of Heaven. And I wanted to get started by talking about what that image evokes for you. I'll get it started a little bit. I started thinking of a banquet hall, like a big Chinese buffet, only with all kinds of nationalities of food, like endless. And a banquet hall being, you know, a large number of people, I was thinking about all these people that I ever wanted to talk to. And I was thinking, wow, so I'd have anything I wanted to eat and people and ideas that I wanted to kind of soak in. And that's what Banquet Hall of Heaven means to me. So, does that evoke anything for any of you?
Banquet Hall, may I?
Yeah.
Banquet Hall, there's a wonderful book about the era, including Satie and that era of music and art, and it's called The Banquet Years in the late 1800s, when there was a very opulent time in Europe, and the salon life was a life in itself. People would go to the salons and they'd talk and share and argue and produce, and the composers and artists of that day were in that era. And the book, The Banquet Years, and this, The Banquet Hall of Heaven, it implies a richness that maybe we can all tap into. That's all I'll say now.
So the first thing I think of with, is the buffet and the metaphor of choice, that we have the choice of whatever we're going to put on our plate in this lifetime, in this day. What we're going to tune to and what we're going to say, not this. And then the whole banquet hall is like, okay, well, not only do you have a choice, but this is an occasion to be present for. This is a celebration. And then heaven is just, okay, your concept of an infinite bliss. Mm-hmm. So your freedom of your choice to manifest what you want, to be fully present and recognize that this is a great celebration and occasion, and then that it's an infinite bliss and blessing.
Wow.
We're in it right now, right?
Yes.
Yes. I like that.
Yes.
Yes. It works.
Do you have anything you want to add?
When you said with whom would you like to speak, I immediately was Chopin.
Okay.
Because I played a lot of Chopin and really loved it. It was very challenging. And I liked the challenge of it, how fast you had to go. And I've always thought, very interesting person.
Okay.
And then just, yes, the atmosphere of everyone coming together with the intention of having a wonderful time and celebration and all of that.
He was very young and brilliant. He didn't live a long time, Chopin, am I correct?
I think you're right, yeah.
Oh, you have it. Oh, my. Eyeballs will pick up on what I need out of this.
I brought my undergraduate music history book.
Yes.
Wonderful. He and a friend, I guess, were talking about it on Facebook. So I thought I would bring mine. David, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. Two images are in there. One's the banquet hall means surprises and delights. Because you go into one, you don't know what you're going to see. And some of it could be amazing, you know, and food you'd never tried before. So it's like you walk into a life, you don't know what it's going to be.
Right.
So to me, it's a banquet hall. It's just like life that you walk into. Expect wonderful things and surprises.
I agree. And also, there's this aspect of people come and go. They don't have to stay. And so you never run out of conversation or food.
Yeah.
That does sound like heaven.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
So there are several topics in this chapter. One is immortality. There's also, did you find Chopin's?
No, I didn't bring my reading glasses in.
Oh, that.
So it's too small for me.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
At the break, I'll look it up. let's see, there's immortality and the Sermon by the Sea. And then lastly, there was a fable about time, eternity, and the timeless. Now, the Sermon by the Sea was given by Holmes near the end of his life after a week at Asilomar, which is a retreat out in California. I don't think we use that as a religious science retreat area anymore, but it was well known. So I wanted to, this isn't what my real topic is, but I wanted to start out with a quote from him that I thought really applies to living today. It would be wonderful indeed if a group of persons should arrive on earth who were for something and against nothing. This would be the summum bonum of human organization, wouldn't it? It is in the life of the individual. Find me one person who is for something and against nothing, who was redeemed enough not to condemn others out of the burden of his soul, and I'll find another Savior, another Jesus, and an exalted human being. Find me one person who no longer has any fear of the universe, or of God, or of man, or of anything else, and you will have brought to me someone in whose presence we may sit and fear shall vanish as clouds before the sunlight. Find me someone who has redeemed his own soul, and he shall become my redeemer. Find me someone who has given all that he has in love without morbidity, and I will have found the lover of my soul. Is this not true? Why? Because he will have revealed to me the nature of God and proved to me the possibility of all human souls. And this is one of the most famous quotes from Holmes. And I keep thinking of, you know, whenever we start talking about politics or I hear a political discussion, I remember, find me somebody who's for something and against nothing. And
excuse me, where does that appear? Where does that quote appear?
In
here?
Yes, in the chapter, The Banquet Hall of Heaven.
Got it.
And there's a subheading of Sermon by the Sea.
Thank you.
But the topic that really grabbed my attention was immortality. So one of the things, and I hadn't really thought about this in a while, but one of the things that really interested me is the idea that our souls go through body after body ad infinitum. There's no beginning, no end. So you look around the room, and this is a point in time in eternity in what we call 2018, and the people here, we've known each other in the past, and we'll see each other again. You know, we just keep cycling through lives and through people. And according to Holmes, we pass from one life to the next with complete retention of all our faculties. And imagine the possibilities. I just thought about it, and I thought, wow, I take everything with me into my next life. And who says I can't pre-program my next life, too? So who I am right now is the sum of all the learning I've done in my past lifetimes, in what I know now and have felt, and everything I'm feeling right now sitting in this room will pass with me when I leave my physical body. So when you think about it, we're not becoming immortal. We are already immortal. And a couple of bodies from now, just think about how much more knowledgeable you're going to be. And connecting this to that banquet hall, the image of the banquet hall of heaven, you can see how the idea of abundance and variety, not only in this life, but apply to our immortal beings, that we can have all kinds of experiences. And so there are infinite incarnations. Holmes says, it seems that our work in the next world will be a continuation of our work in this one. We should not look forward to a heaven where there will be nothing to do, but to a place where our work will be one in greater harmony with the divine law because of a better understanding of it. So, in other words, not only do we take everything, you know, we're working on now and are learning, but we, you know, the more we learn, the more we're able to be in harmony with all that is, which is part of us, of course. And of course, there's other things that are immortal, you know, ideas and, of course, music. Because music, you know, we have CDs, we have cassette tapes, we have performances, we have scores of music, and art is another example. I mean, there's some art that will live on forever. Think of cave paintings, or think of museums and the art that's in there. Yeah, so maybe, you know, the museums will go away someday, but the art will remain forever. And the other aspect of music and art is the impact that they have on people. So you listen to music, you listen to Chopin, and you take that with you into your next incarnations. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Charles Ives, who was born on October 20th, so it would have been yesterday. He was born in 1874 in Danbury, Connecticut. That's another reason I'm bringing him up, because that's real close to where my dad lives, and I'm spending a lot of time there now. Danbury, Connecticut used to be the hat city. And the state of Connecticut itself, it used to be the insurance capital of the world. So his dad was an army band leader in the Civil War, and he taught music and music theory. And Ives himself became a church organist at the age of 14, which showed what enormous talent that guy had. And later on, he moved to New Haven and went to Yale University. And I don't know if he liked beer or not, but he did study composition. He continued playing the organ until 1902, when he moved to New York, and he worked in an actuarial department in the Mutual Life Insurance Company and founded his own insurance company. And, of course, my dad is the one who turned me on to Charles Ives, because he was a guy who had enormous musical talent, but also tremendous success in the business world as well. And my father was the one that introduced me to music as a child. He would take me to go hear the Hartford Symphony when they had the kids' programs in the afternoon. And I think about, like, when I started playing in orchestra and things like that in elementary school and high school, he would come to all the concerts. And so I have him to thank for a lot of my interest in music that continues to this day. But getting back to Charles Ives, he was one of the most radical composers of the 20th century, and probably was the first great American composer. You could argue others, but the thing that I was listening to a bunch of his music on YouTube, and he composed a piece for two pianos that were tuned a quarter tone apart.
Yes.
And it was an amazing experience, because it sounded like one was totally out of tune. So if you get a chance, Google quarter tone and Ives, and you get to hear that piece. It's mind-blowing. But you think to yourself, how did that idea come up? And, of course, quarter tones in Western music are not something that by the way, quarter tone is when you go do, re.
Let me demonstrate.
Yeah.
The chromatic scale, like on the piano, all of the adjacent keys would be. Those are tones, half tones. Quarter tones would be. You're getting it? Halfway in between. I'm not demonstrating it very well, but you hear how it makes your ears work in a different way, in a way apart from what we're used to every day. It'd be like having frets on a guitar, where there are extra frets now, halfway between all the other frets.
Right. I think it's best demonstrated on stringed instruments that don't have frets, like a violin. But yes, you would hear music with quarter tones in Eastern music. And so it's not so familiar here in the Western Hemisphere. And another thing that I thought was really interesting was because of his dad's engagement with the military, he wrote a piece that emulates two marching bands that are walking across a field in opposite directions. So they're coming towards each other, and then they cross. It's a fabulous piece of music. But, you know, you think, where did this creativity come from? And I think that perhaps he carried that in from another life, because he wasn't alive yet when his dad was a bandmaster in the Civil War. Maybe the town of Danbury had a band, and he listened to that. But he had all these ideas that aren't taught. I didn't, you know, in traditional music training, I didn't hear about quarter tones. And yet, this is something that he came up with, and many composers, like Leonard Bernstein, recognize his creativity. So it's back to the theme of immortality and taking what you have in one life and employing it in another life. And I know there's many composers like that, including your friend Mr. Satie.
Yes.
You want to talk about him a little bit?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I don't have Eric Satie's years with me, but he was a very rebellious sort of a person within creativity. He was stretching his imagination a lot, and the imagination of other people, too. I want to reach for something while I'm talking. But he was willing to break the rules and to try new things. He was good friends with Debussy. I brought something for show and tell. I'll pass it around during our time together here. But Eric Satie would take long walks. One of his morning routines was to walk. And so many creative people did walk. They walked a lot to stimulate their imaginations, their creativity. And this particular work, it's 20 short pieces for piano. And what this product was based on, some illustrations that a newspaper editor had. And he first approached Stravinsky. And Stravinsky didn't want to do it. He wanted too much money. So the editor approached Satie. And the editor offered him the same amount of money. And he said, well, that's too much, but I'll do it anyway. So he was on the opposite end. And he took the illustrations, and in his own music lettering, in his own calligraphy, he wrote the titles. And he has some very strange directions in some of his pieces. Like he will write sometimes without blinking.
Without blinking?
Yes. Play the piece without blinking. And some other things. I'll pass it on. I won't attempt to paraphrase. But so this is a little reproduction. And the illustrations were by Charles Martin, an artist of those times. I'll pass it around to the right. But also at one point, Satie, as with a lot of artists, he wasn't very obsessed with financial success. But one time he won 3,000 francs in a composition concert. And with the money, maybe all of it, maybe with some, I don't know, but he bought 13 identical gray velvet suits with little hats also. And I think he might be wearing one of the hats in one of the suits there. But he 13 suits. And when he was in his last days, his room was very bare. He had rigged up a string set up where he could open or close the door from his bed. And there was almost nothing in the room except for the suits that were piled up on top of his bureau. And those were among the last things he had. And he was an associate of Claude Debussy, and they were both associated with a mystical order that was that has come and gone over history called the Rosicrucian Order. And that's a compilation of teachings. There are many ideas associated with the Rosicrucians. But the Rosicrucians are very much in attunement with the teachings of Ernest Holmes. You might put them in the category of New Thought. And so all of these things go together very much. So the two of them were associated with a Rosicrucian lodge, and Satie wrote some pieces. He wrote about three pieces for officers of the lodge.
Hmm.
Like there is a maître, and there's a master of the lodge, and certain ritualistic officers. And he wrote some pieces for the lodge, not for the people holding the positions, but for those roles, ritualistic roles. And on the piano, he wrote a lot of, he wrote mostly on the piano. I'm not aware that he played any other instruments. So he and Debussy were friends. I think that Satie was a little intimidated by Debussy's ability. It's a possibility that they were not on the same par, or at least Satie didn't think that they were on the same par. He was a little bit under Debussy's reputation and ability. So that's what I can contribute about Eric Satie.
And he was 1866 to 1925, so it makes sense that he would have the spiritualist and New Thought available to him.
Thank you. Thank you. You got that from the book?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Bethany, for looking at that.
And yeah, most of his compositions were for the piano. And Grout calls him an eccentric genius. And I think, I mean, your description of him fits that perfectly. But he influenced a lot of other composers. And he became like a symbol of a movement that continued through, you know, with Stravinsky, Poulenc, Mio, Honegger, and many others. You know, just this, the thought. You know, even after his death, he died of alcoholism, by the way. And his thought continued. And
so if he died of alcoholism?
Man, it was only 60.
That's young in my eyes. I won't see that year anymore. You know, the idea of alcoholism, though, in those times they were very fond of an alcoholic beverage called absinthe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it can be obtained now, but it's probably a different... different recipe, I'm not sure. I'm not really into that. I bought a little bottle about a year ago because I wanted to see, you know, what the big draw was, but I haven't opened it yet. I'm not inclined. If I have something, it's going to be a beer or a glass of wine, maybe twice a month or something, not much. The point, though, is that that had some hallucinogenic qualities, and so some people got really plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
To an inordinate fondness for absinthe.
Well, taken in great quantities, wasn't it actually toxic to the body?
Probably.
I can't remember what it's made from. I think it's risky. There's something in it, wormwood or something.
That's it, wormwood.
Makes it potentially toxic, perhaps.
Good to know. Mm. I'll stay away from it.
I've never heard of anyone drinking that.
Okay.
Well, so, you know, the point that John and I are making is that a lot of these ideas are kind of radical. And what's interesting is that Satie and Ives and many other composers were contemporaries. So it's like they were in the banquet hall when they were serving some fresh ideas. And so they have an impact on the music that we hear today. Now, there are a lot of people that, you know, have seen beyond the physical plane, and they can connect with others that have moved on beyond. And, of course, many of us know of Abraham, who's channeled by Esther Hicks, and then Steve Stephen here listens to Steve Rother, who channels the group. But, you know, you think about it, you don't really need to be a channel to be able to connect with somebody that no longer exists in the physical plane. And it's as though you can sense when people, if you're in the right frame of mind, you can actually connect with somebody that has passed on to the next plane. And, you know, my favorite example is Kate Hannigan, who is a founding member of this group. And I feel Kate's presence so often. And even though she's been dead for, what, 10 years, David?
Wow, already. Oh, my.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. I can still feel her presence. And you think about, like, if you've given birth, when you first lay eyes on your child, a lot of times there's that instant connection. And I'm starting to think it's remembering that person from a past life. And I think there's so many examples of that. Or if you're in the grocery store, you go through the line and you start talking to somebody and you don't normally talk to, you know, like me, I'm kind of an introvert. I wouldn't normally talk to people. But sometimes you just feel that pull. So you can feel that connection too, that immortal connection, either with a living person or with a person that's passed on that was really close to you. So what Holmes says is, I believe in the continuation of the personal life beyond the grave, in the continuity of the individual stream of consciousness with a full recollection of itself and the ability to know and make itself known. I wish to feel when the experience of physical death shall occur that which I really am will continue to live beyond the grave. I wish to feel that I shall again meet those friends whose lives and influences have made my life happy while on earth. So it started making me think, well, okay, so if we live in a world of infinite possibilities, why don't we stay in our bodies infinitely? It'd be kind of nice, you know. It means you don't have to get to know new people. You always have the same people there. Your animals never die. I would have Dahlia for the rest of my life. The problem is right now our bodies are set up to age. At least that's our belief system. And so we don't normally live past, say, 85, I think is the norm for women today. And maybe a little earlier than that for men. But, you know, there are exceptions. And so Holmes has a great way of explaining that. Nature will not let us stay in any one place too long. She allows us to stay just long enough to gather the experience necessary to the unfolding and advancement of the soul. This is wise, for should we stay here too long, we'd become too set, too rigid, and too inflexible. That would be me. She demands the change in order that we may advance. When the change comes, we should welcome it with a smile on the lips and a song on the heart. And I can tell you, as a teenager, I did pass over briefly. I was in the hospital, and it was like the best experience in my life. And I highly recommend it for all of us at some point. You know, just that feeling of ecstasy when you are free of your body, and it's like you feel, it's like the body kind of holds you in, but when you're free of your body, you just feel this tremendous expansion and love. But on the other end, so, you know, you go and you have a great time, but when you're left behind, you know, you lose a loved one, your friend, your pets, your husband or wife, and so we do experience grief, and I think we've all experienced that at one time, particularly as we get older and our friends or family move on. So Holmes says, and remember, he lost his wife Hazel after a number of years being happily married, and he said, it is human to grieve over the loss of dear ones. We would not wish it to be otherwise. We love them and cannot help missing them. But a true realization of immortality and the continuity of the individual will rob our grief of any sense of hopelessness. We shall know that loving friends have met them and that their life still flows on with the currents of eternity. We shall feel that we have not lost them. They have only gone before. And we'll see them again. So that's time for a break.
Okay. Deep words, Mother.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.